30-day guarantee, but no money back. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Last night, former President Clinton said his wife, nominee Hillary Clinton, could make any trouble spot better in 30 days. So could she fix Syria in just a month?
Very hard to change that in 30 days, you know, either to destroy ISIS or to get rid of Assad in 30 days.
Also, a former U.S. ambassador reacts to Donald Trump's latest foreign policy pronouncement, inviting Russia to find the Democratic nominee's missing emails.
Incredible. Shocking, Marco. I can't think of other words. I mean, he's basically encouraging the Russian intelligence services to steal information from an American.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. We try to avoid beltway politics on the show, but today there's no getting around it, and there's news from both sides of the political aisle. Reaction to Hillary Clinton's nomination coming up in a few minutes. But first, a pretty extraordinary moment in Doral, Florida today. Republican nominee Donald Trump was giving a news conference and was asked about the allegations that Russia hacked DNC emails in an attempt to support his candidacy. Trump, who has said before that he knows Russian President Vladimir Putin well, said this.
I have nothing to do with Russia. I'm not going to tell Putin what to do. Why should I tell Putin what to do? What do I have to get involved with Putin for? I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him other than he will respect me. He doesn't respect our president.
And then he went on.
I will tell you this. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
I'm joined by Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia. I guess we should make a little warning here. That's kind of confusing because Mr. Trump is kind of conflating two email scandals, Hillary Clinton's missing emails while she was Secretary of State, which FBI Director Comey had investigated and put to rest saying there was not evidence to indict, and then the hack of the Democratic National Committee emails, which researchers say Russia did, though Russia denies that. So that's the backstory. Tell us what your reaction was to what Donald Trump is saying.
Incredible. Shocking, Marco. I can't think of other words. I mean, he's basically encouraging the Russian intelligence services to steal information from an American and an American government official, former American government official. I can't remember any American ever suggesting that we should help the Russians steal our information, let alone one running for the president of the United States.
Yeah, so what kind of outcome could this potentially have for both the U.S. election and for U.S.-Russia relations?
Well, the particular quip that he said today about, you know, please steal our data, you know, the voters can decide whether they think that's the kind of person that they want to be defending our national interests. And by the way, when he says, I have nothing to do with Putin, well, if you're president, you have a lot to do with Putin. We have lots of issues that we have to deal with the Russians. So, you know, I listen to that and I get very nervous about American leadership in the world and particularly how we're going to deal with Russia. But, you know, ultimately the American voters get to decide that, not me.
So in the meantime, what should be the response from the U.S. government and what would now appear to be a national security issue?
Well, there's his quip, which is he's encouraging Russia to steal information. And I hope there's some address to that and some response to that. And hopefully Mr. Trump will realize that he, you know, went too far with that, as he often does. And then he says, I didn't mean that. I mean, already on the social media, it's all just a joke now. He was just making a joke. It's kind of like joking about guns when you're in the TSA line. But, you know, maybe he can retract it.
Who should be giving the response if there is a response from the U.S. government to give? The president, Secretary of State Kerry, the current U.S. ambassador to Russia?
I think ultimately it needs to be at a very high level. You know, right now, if you read what U.S. government officials are saying on the record and on background, they're saying, give us time to complete our investigation. This has happened a while ago, so I'm just assuming and hoping that they've been investigating ever since we knew about this.
Let me just ask you this, too. As a former ambassador to Russia, what do you think the current ambassador is thinking right now?
That's a good question. Well, let me just be clear. We've focused a lot on the, you know, what the Russians have done to the DNC, But let's not be naive. This is not the first attack against U.S. government officials or entities or American organizations. And my guess is that the entire embassy in Moscow is wondering about other attacks and you know, ways to be more vigilant in stopping these kinds of things from the ambassador on down.
Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now to the Democrats. Last night, former President Bill Clinton spoke in support of his wife, Hillary, who secured her party's nomination yesterday. Bill Clinton spent a lot of time touting his wife's abilities, but there was one of his comments about her diplomatic skills that really caught our attention.
You could drop her into any trouble spot. Pick one. Come back in a month, and somehow, some way, she will have made it better. That is just who she is.
Okay, let's try this out. I'm picking Syria. So what could Hillary Clinton, if she put her mind to it and focused only on Syria, what could be accomplished in a month there? Since a civil war in Syria began in 2011, we've turned often for good counsel to Joshua Landis. He directs Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Landis has studied and written about Syria for years. In fact, he lived there before the war. So, Josh Landis, if a President Hillary Clinton gave Syria her full attention for a month, how could she make things better in 30 days? And I know Syria is very complex, so if you want to see 30 days as a kind of aspirational goal, that's fine.
Well, it'd be very hard to really affect any major change in 30 days. That, I'm afraid, any president could not do. But we're hanging in between two different policy proposals that Washington is arguing about. One is to have a rapprochement with Russia and to try to concentrate only on destroying ISIS and al-Qaeda and teaming up with the Russians in order to do that. That means ignoring the fact that Assad remains in power.
That's the current policy of the Obama administration, correct?
And Obama's been moving towards that. It's caused a hue and cry in Washington. There have been diplomats who've gone to protest against this. There are others who say, no, we can't, we should not be helping Russia out.
So what's the other policy? Is that about confronting Russia?
That's confronting Russia, yes. To confront Russia in Syria, because we have to stick it to Assad. We have to help the Sunni rebel militias. And these are two really very different policies, and they stem from different analysis of what's caused the Syrian problem. Is it Assad that's really behind the Syrian problem, or is it the Islamist extremists that are intertwined with the Syrian rebels? And so Clinton, in a sense, has taken the side of regime change. By taking down a dictatorial regime, we will, in a sense, combat Islamic extremism at the same time. Others say, no, that's foolish. You get rid of the state, you cause chaos, and Islamic extremists expand. And that's really the policy debate. Very hard to change that in 30 days or to really affect, you know, either to destroy ISIS or to get rid of Assad in 30 days.
Josh Landis, I just have to ask you, how much do you think about a President Trump and all these kind of stories about his relationship with Vladimir Putin and what that would do to the war in Syria?
Well, you know, in some ways, it's not that different from President Obama's policy, which is to talk with Russia, work with Putin to try to destroy ISIS. That means allowing Russia to have Assad stay there. So Trump, in a sense, accepted that policy, which is very interesting because it is miles away from the traditional Republican policy. He really has reversed Republican foreign policy in the Middle East.
Josh Landis directs Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thanks very much, as always.
Pleasure.
There was another remark Bill Clinton made last night we want to talk about. It came near the end of his speech.
If you're a Muslim and you love America and freedom and you hate terror, stay here and help us win and make a future together. We want you.
I've got Blair Imani with me. She's a community activist, and you are also a Muslim woman. You're also black. How did you feel about Bill Clinton's comments last night on Muslims and African Americans?
Well, I really felt like he was coming from a genuine place. But I also, you know, we have to acknowledge that it's difficult to be a white man and kind of speak to these issues in an elegant way because, you know, he hasn't experienced the marginalization that different groups have that I have. But I also know that he is trying to call people together because of my, like, personal experience with him in condemning Islamophobia.
Yeah, so well-intentioned, but dig deeper into his comments. What specifically kind of rubbed you the wrong way?
You know, reading transcript versus hearing it live, when you have the little caveat that says you hate terror, that to some people will suggest that Muslims are complicit in terror attacks. And I completely disagree with that. And I would say that Bill Clinton disagrees with that, too. But I think that when you kind of put those two phrases together, it sounds like you're asking marginalized folks to condemn acts that have nothing to do with themselves by virtue of their identity. And I think that was some of the backlash that kind of ruffled feathers.
Yeah, I mean, your sense is that his comments were well meant. But do you think a lot of people in the U.S. are struggling to find the right language to talk about this stuff?
Oh, definitely. It's an uncomfortable conversation. There's the sweeping narrative that, you know, all Muslims are somehow connected to or involved in terrorism. And there's also the narrative that all protesters and all Black Lives Matter activists hate police. And it's so much easier to do that than to be in the reality of the situation and to talk about the nuance. And it's a lot more difficult to get, you know, hits on your website for a mainstream media outlet if you're talking about nuanced issues versus these very poignant talking points.
So help us out here, Blair. What do you think Clinton should have said instead? Give us the language.
I think that it was I'm not a speechwriter, but I think that it was a point that needs to be said. I think that it's important to uplift Muslims, Black people in America, and the hardships that we all experience, I experience at the intersections of it. But I really wish that he had said what he told me when I was actually able to meet him briefly.
Yeah, I mean, the backstory to that meeting. I mean, you were actually called a terrorist by someone while you were fundraising for Hillary Clinton's campaign. And Bill Clinton personally apologized to you after that.
Yeah, so that was really amazing, and I felt really blessed. I just recently started wearing hijab in March, and a month later, I was going to this fundraising event for Hillary Clinton, and I was, very excited. I spent hours coordinating my outfit, speaking to my mom, who's not Muslim, who, is always just very concerned about how I'm going to be received in different spaces. And I was like, mom, like, we're all, Democrats. It shouldn't be a problem. It wasn't even in my head that it would be an issue. But I walked past this group of older men, and I hear one of them say, "Oh, looks like we got a terrorist in our midst." And it's like, oh, it was so crushing because I'm new to D.C. I was very excited to be going to a fundraiser like this. And so then I went to my car, and another organizer came out, saw me crying. And I kind of drove around for a little while. I called my mom, called a couple of my friends, and I was just like, this is so awful. What do I do? And while I was on the phone with my mother, I actually get a call from that same organizer. I get the call, "Hello, Blair. I'm so sorry about what happened to you, but Mr. Clinton would like to meet you." And I was like, what? that was like, if you could make a situation perfect after something so horrible happened, that would be the way. And as I'm parking my car, I see like all the, Secret Service agents like kind of motioning me over. So I'm like running over. And then one of the agents was like, it's fine. You take your time. Just walk over here. And they had me wait by the car as Bill walked down the steps. And he actually heard about the situation. He actually cared. And so he, shook my hand and like told me basically that, Islamophobia has no place in America. That is not what I stand for. That's not what Hillary stands for. And he was like just so apologetic of the fact that somebody with such bigoted ideas had made their way to an event where he would be speaking.
Community activist Blair Imani, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a radio station in South Africa that combats homophobia, the story of gay SA radio, ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Back to Philly and the DNC for a few minutes. Tonight, President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden are scheduled to speak. Both are expected to rally behind Hillary Clinton, who was officially nominated last night. Leo Hornack is usually in our offices at the BBC in London, but we've sent him to both conventions to get his take on the American political process. Leo, these conventions, as I'm sure you've now seen, are big spectacles. Part of the furniture of these spectacles are the buttons, the signs, T-shirts. What have you been seeing?
Well, part of the fun as well, Marco. I mean, I think that is one of the things that has really surprised me, is just how much of a conversation in each convention is going on in terms of what people are wearing, the slogans they're waving. When Michelle Obama was speaking, it was just this forest of people waving placards with the word Michelle on it, which makes the photo at the end incredibly impressive because you have her smiling there and tens of thousands of people holding up her name. And now, obviously, that is being very carefully thought through by the convention headquarters. And it is noticeable when you're here just how carefully organized everything is. I mean, what it reminds me of, in a way, in Britain during the Tony Blair era, the Labour Party, which was ruling, became incredibly organized. And this actually produced a big backlash because everything was micromanaged. What I'm seeing here, I don't know if it does produce a backlash in the American context, but you do, I think, if I was a Bernie Sanders supporter, a little part of me might be kind of rolling my eyes when I see, you know, the Michelle placards coming out on like a conveyor belt through the Democrat machine.
Right. So there are these official posters that are distributed by the DNC. Then there are the unofficial signs. What about those?
When it's unofficial, I think the gloves come off a bit more as well, because it hasn't been kind of focus group tested. So, you know, I've seen a poster or a T-shirt rather with Bernie Sanders' Assault on Wall Street, with him as a kind of gun-toting action hero charging through New York and laying it waste. Probably not what the Hillary Clinton campaign would have chosen. Another one was a bag with "Girls Just Want to Have Fundamental Rights," which I've got that here as a tote bag. I quite like that one.
So that's what you've been seeing in Philadelphia. How does that compare with what you saw last week in Cleveland?
Much, much more negative when I was at the Republicans. I mean, Hillary for prison. I've got a pin here that we got "Girls Just Want to Have Guns," which was the Republican version of the "Girls Just Want to Have Fundamental Rights" here this week. Yeah, and lots of stuff about guns, lots of stuff about building a wall. I mean, it is noticeable that one difference, it is more negative, but they are focused on policies, the Republican T-shirts. I'm pretty confident, I'm pretty clear, the Republicans want to build a wall and they want to end immigration. I'm pretty clear about that.
You are?
I got it pretty loud and clear, I will say that.
Just compare for us how this emphasis on slogans with buttons and signs and posters, how does it differ from what happens in the UK?
I was just looking through some photos of past British major political conventions. Not a single placard is being waved. Everyone is seated just like almost like a classical concert, looking at the stage. There may be some posters waved at some point, but you're certainly not getting the people dressed from head to toe in the Union Jack flag. You're certainly not getting, you know, people dressed as elephants or donkeys to symbolize their love of their party. Doesn't really happen.
You know, I wanted to share something with you. I've kind of noticed a rebranding of Hillary Clinton at this convention. I turned my thoughts back to the 1996 convention. There was this button circulating with Hillary Clinton's face, but Dennis Rodman's fluorescent hair, and it said Hillary Rodman Clinton, bad as she wants to be. She was something of a rebel wife, a woman with big ideas about healthcare. Do you see any signs of that persona at this convention?
Well, I hope that someone has come up with something as good as that and is proudly wearing it right now here in Philadelphia, but I haven't seen it. I mean, I've seen a few slogans that are pretty memorable. Like, one I liked was, "Behind every great woman is herself." That kind of captures the exciting and positive message of the Clinton campaign, I think, this week. Just the emphasis on the fact that this could be the first female president.
The world's Leo Hornack at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Good to speak with you as always, Leo.
Thanks very much, Marco.
Let's tune in now to another radio stream. Gay SA Radio broadcasts out of the South African capital, Pretoria. It bills itself as Africa's only gay radio station. Our colleagues at the BBC spent the day at Gay SA and met some of the folks behind it.
Morning, this is Gay SA Radio and I am Hendrik. I'm the station manager of Africa's first radio station that is aimed at lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and intersex people. The whole house has been converted into a studio and office space, and we're using this as a beacon of light into South Africa and to the rest of Africa.
This is the Steam Room on Gay SA Radio, where you are family.
Hi, my name is Wasim. I present The Steam Room, which is a show that deals with gay sex and relationships. One of the things is that, you know, I'm a gay Muslim man, so it's also kind of unique when people hear that a gay Muslim man is presenting a sex show, a sex relationship show. So I'm trying to change a bit of people's mindsets regarding that.
Certainly homophobia is still a big challenge. If you look at somebody who's beaten to a pulp and left for dead outside a pub, there's obviously still a huge amount of hatred and violence aimed at gay and lesbian people. The whole issue of lesbian rape. This month is about history of being gay. Or going back. We think that it's important to educate. Do you think young people know the history of Pride and the whole gay liberation movement?
I did not know until I did research on it. And I think majority of people out there still don't know what Pride is all about, because mostly majority of us go there for the tenor.
We want to bring an entertainment aspect to it, and it is always from a gay perspective.
I kissed a girl. Have you ever kissed a girl, Chris?
Plenty times, and I liked it. And I liked it.
Gay SA Radio, where you are family.
You can call me Sugar Man. I'm the Sugar Man of radio. I'm straight, but the reason why I got involved with Gay SA Radio, in a way, we are all affected. We all got gay cousins, gay relatives. And I think it's my duty to raise awareness and teach people that we gay people are all normal and we can all get together and have a wonderful time. I think gay people are the most wonderful people in the world.
In studio already is Belu Kay. He's a dancer from the State Theatre. He's going to be telling us a little bit more on the relationship between dance and choreography.
I think it's important for gay people to have a voice, especially on the African continent. There are so many countries that have a very repressive legislation, and Gay SA Radio is really the only place where gay people have a voice and can actually say things that are important not only to them but also to demystify homosexuality. I'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning at 6. Catch me then. Remember, I love ya.
Hendrik Baird there. He's the station manager of Gay SA Radio in Pretoria, South Africa. He was speaking with our partners at the BBC. News headlines are coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The threat from ISIS is serious, but the group could be losing ground to Al-Qaeda.
It's very likely that Al-Qaeda will be able to do to ISIS what ISIS wanted to do to Al-Qaeda, that is, steal major parts of the ISIS network away from it.
And that's why ISIS is tweaking its message. That's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. ISIS is losing. That's according to the U.S. State Department's point man on the group. According to him, ISIS has lost almost half its territory in Iraq and Syria, and the group's leaders are being picked off by precision strikes. Other U.S. officials contend that ISIS ground troops have been killed by the thousands. It looks like ISIS has started to acknowledge this reality in its propaganda. The message to potential recruits is certainly evolving. The World's Matthew Bell has that story.
Starting in 2014, when the fighters of ISIS shocked the world by seizing vast swaths of Syria and Iraq, their public relations people crafted a pitch that went like this. They told young Muslims to come, join the caliphate of the prophecy, be part of history. They said ISIS was building the Islamic State described in the Quran. The message now, though, is different. That's the voice of the official spokesman for ISIS, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani. The audio statement was released in May, and in this section, Adnani says ISIS will be victorious no matter how much territory it loses in Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Even if it loses the cities of Mosul, Sirte, and Raqqa, Adnani says, the fighters of ISIS will never lose their will to fight. ISIS is not giving up on its so-called caliphate just yet, but it's sending an important signal, says J.M. Berger of George Washington University. He's the co-author of ISIS, the State of Terror. Berger says Adnani's statement was trying to lay the groundwork for the future.
He basically said, you know, even if we lose all of our territory, we'll still fight the insurgency like we did before. It's not quite a full concession, but it is preparing their followers for the likely reality.
Doesn't that decimate their legitimacy if they were supposedly creating this state? Well, now they're losing.
It takes a lot of air out of the balloon, but not all of it.
The thing about extremists, Berger says, is that they're not easily dissuaded by reality. Many of the followers of ISIS will persist in their radical beliefs no matter how many cities it loses. Still, Berger says the facts on the ground will undermine the group's support and its recruiting efforts.
a lot of their initial success in propaganda was based on a narrative that they were a very successful group, that they were holding this territory, that they had done things that nobody else had ever done. So it will be harder for them to mount that claim. I think it's going to hurt them, but I don't think it's going to end them.
It doesn't take much for ISIS to claim responsibility for acts of terrorism, and there have been plenty to choose from in recent weeks and months. David Gartenstein-Ross at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies says ISIS was never just about state building, but now, he says, the group has made global terrorism a top priority.
As they lose ground, they need to show that they're still strong. The way they could do that is by trying to surge terrorist attacks, by trying to coordinate them. And we saw that during this past Ramadan. It was an extraordinarily bloody month with multiple terrorist attacks across at least 10 different countries across the globe that were claimed in the name of ISIS, which shows that the group is still very lethal, very capable. And you know, losing 25% or 40% of their state doesn't mean they lose 25 or 40% of their capabilities to carry out attacks abroad.
The message from ISIS now to wannabe jihadists living in the West is to stay put and carry out acts of terrorism at home, no matter how small. Gartenstein-Ross says this is a dangerous moment, but what's more dangerous would be letting ISIS hold on to its safe havens in places like Syria.
If you look at the massive network that carried out the attacks in Paris and Brussels, it was comprised of a number of people who had gone over to Syria and either had experience on the battlefield or received training while over there, and were able to carry out this very large-scale attack. Being able to go to the caliphate and to train there or to fight there can really increase someone's competence level.
That doesn't mean smaller-scale attacks can't be deadly. Two men, apparently inspired by ISIS, murdered an 84-year-old French priest this week in his church. European police say well over 1,000 potential ISIS fighters have returned to Europe from Syria and Iraq. One top official said the terrorist group is lashing out as it faces the beginning of its long, slow decline. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Matthew mentioned that attack at a church in France this week. Germany, too, has suffered a string of deadly incidents recently, some of which seem to be inspired by ISIS. Jörg Lau is foreign editor at the newspaper Die Zeit. He joins us from Berlin. What is the current mood in Germany following a week of attacks there?
Well, there's a general sense of anxiety because it's very unpredictable. These attacks, they seem to be connected in a way, but they are not. And it's hard to figure out if this is a campaign or if it's just a coincidence or if there's some kind of contagion. So people are nervous, people are anxious. It's safe to go to public places, but until now, there's not too much of political hysteria about this situation.
When you say political hysteria, what would you be referring to?
The propositions that have been made by German politicians until now have been pretty reasonable. I mean, we already have a very tough law concerning weapons in this country, so you can't do much to make it even more strict. And there have been no propositions until now to not let any Muslims into the country anymore or other radical populist ideas. I mean,
how does that go over?
Until now, the debate has been pretty reasonable, I think, because what we're dealing with is actually quite hard to figure out. For example, the person who committed this mass killing in Munich is of German-Iranian descent. And the first idea everybody had was this might be some kind of radical Islamist act that's going on here. But it turns out there's actually some kind of racist Aryan supremacist ideology involved here, much more related to what the Norwegian Anders Breivik did some years ago.
Racist ideology on the part of the shooter, this Iranian-German.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it doesn't fit any pattern. And it's very hard for the public here to figure out what we're dealing with. On the other hand, we have people who commit crimes and say they pledge allegiance to ISIS. So it's a mix of a violence perpetrated by people who seem to be mentally destabilized, even borderline crazy, and also radicalized.
So if you were to ask a sampling of Germans what they think the threat is there, what would they say?
Some refer to the decision last year by the chancellor to open the borders to hundreds of thousands of refugees as a reason. But if you look at the cases we're dealing with, it really doesn't make much sense because most of these people have been here longer.
So then would they say, well, it's then a matter of security? Is that what they say?
Yeah, it's a matter of security. But then again, I mean, most of these acts seem to be lone wolf attacks, and it's really hard to control these people or to even figure out who is a threat. Most of these people are not part of elaborate networks that you can easily police and control. So Germany is just part of this global problem now of this lone wolf terrorism that seems to be on the rise.
Are some Germans calling for deportations?
No, this is interesting.
Nobody's calling for deportations.
Really nobody.
Right. And the German government has refused to deport, but they are considering closing the borders. Where does that stand?
We've already, in a way, closed the borders. We've made a deal with Turkey that results in almost no more refugees coming here because they cannot cross the Mediterranean anymore as easy as last year. So Germany at the moment has almost no more refugees coming to us. The problem is that with the huge wave of refugees last year, there are many, many people here whose identity is not really known because they were just too many to process for the authorities.
Yeah, I mean, that's problematic because then you don't know who's who. I mean, France has suggested it's overwhelmed by the security problem. Does Germany have enough police?
Well, that's the debate that's starting now, that maybe we should beef up the police, and I think this will happen. It's a sensible policy, and this is also good politically speaking, I think. So I guess we will see a lot of action in this field.
Jörg Lau, foreign editor of Die Zeit newspaper in Berlin. Jörg, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Our next story is about a young woman we've had before on The World. Her name is Ilwad Elman. She's a 26-year-old Somali-Canadian who currently lives in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Yesterday, two major explosions rocked the city, killing 13 people. One of the blasts completely destroyed Elman's house. We contacted her earlier today. She told us that she and her family are safe, but that it was a close call.
It was a very terrifying start to the morning. I was actually on my way down the stairs, getting ready to head out of my house to go to work, when the first explosion happened, when I was met with bricks and glass from the windows that shattered, coming all flying at me. I ran back upstairs, and as I stood in the middle of my room, trying to stay as far as possible from the rest of the windows, and trying to figure out how close or how far this explosion was, another one happened, followed by intense gunfire.
So you personally, any injuries?
No, I'm fine, and I'm very thankful. We rebuild, as we do in Mogadishu, because of the pattern of how frequently these things happen, but we can't restore lives. We can rebuild homes, but we can't restore lives, and we can't afford to normalize these things, not in Somalia or anywhere else in the world.
When these twin explosions happened, what happened to your neighbors? I mean, did people flee? What was the reaction?
Yes, not far from my house, actually, there is an internally displaced people's camp. So hundreds of people just started flooding into the streets, trying to run away from where they thought the explosion happened from. But the challenge that we always face is that after the explosion, there's so much sporadic gunfire that happens. So even if the explosion didn't kill you, there's a strong likelihood that the gunshots that are sprayed indiscriminately in all directions after could. So it was a very scary sight to see.
So when something like this happens, do security forces show up, and is there an attempt to find attackers?
After attacks like this happen, it seems that the standard reaction is always just to shoot indiscriminately, to try to block people from coming into the main roads. So most people just lay low and try to avoid the areas of the attack. And today, it's as though nothing happened. I actually drove to work today, and I saw a foot not far from my house, still laying there. And it's a terrible thing where we normalize these things, that we just try to pick up and resume back to normal as possible. And we don't give time to grief or to acknowledge the human lives that we just lost. And it's one thing that could be attributed to resilience and strength of our people. But I think it also contributes to how frequent these things happen when we just try to pick up from where we left off and we don't spend enough time on investigating what could have been done proactively to prevent such a thing like this instead of just reacting.
That is a grim way to get resilience and strength, I've got to say.
I just feel like we never really have time to really reflect on the human suffering that's happening. Almost every day there's a new headline, and it's not just me in Mogadishu here in a country that's in conflict, but we're seeing it in Istanbul, Nice, Saudi, Dakar, Baghdad, Munich, Normandy. Just today, I think more than 40 people were killed in Syria. The list goes on. We're becoming so desensitized to it that it doesn't matter what part of the world we are anymore. Anything can happen anywhere.
Al-Shabaab militants who carried out the bombing say one of the bombers is a former Somali MP who quit parliament in 2010. This is apparently a guy in his 50s. Don't Somali suicide bombers tend to be young men?
That's the narrative that we hear, usually, that it's mostly young people that are part of Al-Shabaab. The name even specifically targets the youth, which is what it translates to in Arabic. But I think it's not the first case of an elderly person being the person to blow themselves up. But I think it was quite unique that he used to be a former lawmaker. And it's a big shock to a lot of people.
Hmm. Speaking of resilience, I also saw on your Twitter feed a friend of yours writing, we woke up with twin suicide attacks and finished in style with celebrating the victory for the football lovers. And there's a photo attached to the tweet of a huge crowd in Mogadishu watching a soccer game hours after the blast. What can you, residents of Mogadishu, who've been living without a functioning government for 25 years, what can you share with the rest of the world about moving on with life?
I retweeted that of my friends at the football game because it's so important to show that, okay, there is loss of life and there is suffering. There's so much life amidst all the conflict and the ruins as well, too. I think navigating life in Somalia can be best described as somewhere between war and peace, calm amid conflict. But there is life beyond just what we see in the tragedy. And I think that if more people embraced their communities after an attack, it might even contribute to countering violent extremism, because the approach that we see right now in most of the attacks that are happening in Europe, where they target or they exclude or they project certain biases on marginalized communities and make them feel even more unwanted, that could radicalize the innocent. But if we focused more on trying to look at all the things that we can be grateful for, even after devastating attacks, I think that would contribute to communities being able to prevent, I think, extremism if they came together in the face of suffering.
Iwad Elman lives in Mogadishu and directs the Elman Peace and Human Rights Center there. Iwad, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Back to election year politics for a bit now. Author Hector Tobar recently wrote, Latinos won't forget the things Donald Trump has said about them. The Republican candidate has said that immigrants are bringing drugs and crime into the U.S. He's also questioned the neutrality of Indiana-born Judge Gonzalo Curiel because he's got Mexican roots. Tobar recently looked into the get-out-the-vote drives for Latinos in Arizona. He wrote about it in The New Yorker. I wanted to know if Trump motivates Latinos to vote or sours them to the whole process.
I think it definitely motivates them to vote. I feel, this sort of deep sense of hurt personally that this politician who has slandered an entire group of immigrants, entire generation of immigrants, is leading in some polls, that he is treated seriously in the national media. Every time we see this, it really angers and motivates us. And I think it is going to transfer into a great deal of activism and participation at every level of government, every level of voting.
So you're supporting Hillary Clinton in this election, I would guess.
Well, I personally am, yes. I'm going to be voting for Hillary. I know a lot of young Latino people flirted and supported Bernie Sanders in the neighborhood where I live in Los Angeles. There were many Viva Bernie signs. But I think that Hillary is going to do very well in the Latino community. She's already doing very well among older Latinos. And I think she's going to do very, very well among Latinos. The latest polls I've seen have shown Trump support among Latinos dipping as low as 13-14%.
How do you balance that support for Clinton with the high number of deportations under the Obama administration that she was a part of? I mean, some critics on this point call Obama the deporter in chief.
There is a great deal of anger and frustration among Latino people of all ages about the Obama administration's policies. At the same time, people realize that the Obama administration has attempted to push through these initiatives to give millions of immigrants temporary status that have been thwarted by the Republicans in the House and the Senate. I think that people are realizing that we need to have a more of a voice in the process, that there's a limit to what any one leader can do if he lacks the political support to get those things done. So yes, there's definitely a lot of anger, especially among young people. We have noticed that Hillary Clinton has distanced herself from some of these policies. She has embraced the idea of the dreamers, of these undocumented immigrants who were raised as Americans. So we're very hopeful that that things will change after November.
So, I mean, I know it's hard to generalize Latinos all, but do young Latinos feel like they're going to support essentially the lesser of two evils?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think young Latinos have dreams of an immigration reform that embraces almost all 11 million people who are living here undocumented, many of whom have lived here for many, many years and built homes and families. You know, I think increasingly among undocumented immigrants, English is actually the dominant language. When I interview undocumented immigrants, more often than not, I interview them in English. And so there is this sense that we really earned our place through our labor and through our time here in the United States, and that everyone should be included. So I think there's going to be a lot of frustration among young Latino people about who is included and who isn't. But definitely to have a President Trump would be a much, much worse evil.
Hector Tobar wrote, "Can Latinos Swing Arizona?" for The New Yorker. Hector, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. One of the best things about digital technology is how old recorded music gets cleaned up, remastered, and re-released. It's like I'm living in the past, but with new music popping up around me all the time. Here's one of my favorite examples, a new release of old music from Haiti. This stuff comes from the 1960s and 70s, a repressive time in Haiti's history. Papa Doc Duvalier ruled the country with an iron fist, but the dictator was also a strong supporter of the arts. Yeah, these things are never simple. And so what happened? Some great music came out of Haiti during this period. This collection is called Tambou Toujours Lou. It was compiled and curated by DJ, writer, and record collector Vic Sahoni. He told me where the title comes from.
There's a saying in Haiti that I would hear people tell me in Haiti that's Apoué danse, tambou toujours lou. After the dance, the drum is always heavy. Just as a reference to, you know, after the dance, when the drums go into such a hypnotic rhythm, even once they're done playing. So I just thought it was a very fitting title for the compilation.
So what do you think this collection of Haitian music shows us about the cultural life of Haiti in the 60s and the 70s?
We have to remember that Haiti received one of the greatest diversities of people who were forcibly brought over from Africa, and their cultures were such a beautiful syncretic blend that produced so many different rhythms, so many different styles, and those styles were not very prominent under colonialism, and they were often very much repressed. So in the 60s and 70s, there was a huge revivalist movement to go back to these roots culture, at the same time drawing from the various influences that Haiti had, being positioned where it is, next to the United States, next to Cuba, next to Colombia. Mm. You had Haitian bands who were really interpreting so many different influences and making sense of them to work with their own rhythms. And that's really, you know, the crux of this compilation.
I mean, you take a band like Les Loups Noirs, which translates as like the Black Wolves. They've got the song Pele Bien. And it's a swirl of so many different sounds and a lot of experimentation.
Les Loups Noirs is an integral band in Haiti. They were a young band, and they were dedicated more to the African approach than a lot of other bands. Their roots were from the countryside, from the rural side. Almost anything you listen to theirs has a lot of depth, complexity, and sophistication.
I assume you've been to Haiti several times, at the very least, to research this album.
Yes, I have.
What was your musical perfect moment in Haiti?
One of the most special moments I had there was when I was looking for music, and everywhere I asked, I would get laughed at. People were saying, listen, we're laughing at you not because, you know, you're looking for old music, but you have to understand that the earthquake not only destroyed our city, but it destroyed a lot of the archives. Our cultural artifacts had been destroyed, and here you are trying to find something that no longer exists. And one radio owner, his radio station was completely destroyed, so he had set up shop on a rooftop in a really rudimentary kind of radio station, and he invited me onto the show, and he told me that his entire archive was completely destroyed of records. He said, if you came, you know, before the earthquake, I could have probably given you anything you'd wanted. And I sat down on the show, and we just listened to tracks back and forth, and we spoke about them, and it was, that was a really special moment for me in Haiti.
Vic Sahoni there, telling us about a new collection of vintage music from Haiti, Tambu Tujulu. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.